Welcome to the Speakeasy and our new sit-down interview series called Whiskey Made Me Say It. We will interview the most interesting and humorous golfers, whiskey makers, and enthusiasts and enjoy their perspective on life. Sit back and enjoy Whiskey Made Me Say It. Welcome, Fuel Nation. This is Brian Bailey here bringing you a new Whiskey Made Me Say It. Now, granted, I have a good friend of mine that I'm interviewing today, not a whiskey fan. So we have decided to partake in the Irish lector of greatness, Guinness. So we're going to have a Guinness and have a conversation. So it won't be the whiskey made me say it. It's going to be the Guinness made me say it. And I know enough Irishmen, Guinness can make you say a lot. So without further ado, let me introduce Puggy Blackman in. Puggy, how are you doing today?
I'm doing wonderful, but you got to understand, though, that the Guinness is medicinal. Anybody in Ireland that drinks Guinness understands that it cures anything and everything. So I drink it totally. I love it, but it's totally a medicinal thing.
So the Irish live forever. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, yeah. I always tell a Guinness drinker the morning after a good night out on the golf course, because they don't have an issue with gas. So
there you go. Yeah. So no, I think I enjoy a good Guinness. There's no doubt about it. If you've not been in Ireland and actually enjoyed a proper Guinness, what we have here in the States is not Guinness. It's a version of Guinness, but you definitely have to go to Ireland and partake at least once in your lifetime on a true creamy Guinness.
I love Ireland. Is my favorite spot in the world. We would spend a lot more time there if we could, but I will tell you, anybody going to Ireland, just get ready to enjoy a great group of people, very laid back, a lot of fun. And if you go to Ireland, make sure you rent a movie called Waking Ned Devine. It is an incredibly funny, hilarious, old movie about an Irish village that a gentleman won the sweepstakes and died in the meantime, and they figured out a way to collect all the winnings. So it's really before you make your trip. So,
well, here inside of the speakeasy and the whiskey side, and Gareth McShay, who's a friend of mine, Irish golf professional, we have some really cool stuff coming up where we're going to make a couple Ireland golf trips, and we're going to kind of filter in whiskey tasting as well as finding the perfect pint. So we will go play golf during the morning, jump in a van in the afternoon, and go search for the perfect pint of Guinness as well as do different whiskey tasting. So we're putting all that together. Puggy, you have an invite, my friend. I'll have a good time.
I promise you I'll be there.
So the fun thing about this interview series is this is just us going finding interesting people inside the golf industry, just industries in general. And just to kind of give you a highlight, I met Puggy. Oh, it's been a while now. I was coaching at Virginia. When I was coaching, there was very few coaches that I would seek out. But anytime we were in an event with South Carolina, I would go find Puggy and just start talking with him. The one thing you're going to learn from Puggy is he's going to give you great stories, and he has a wealth of golf knowledge and information. So I couldn't think of a better guest to have on this show. So, Puggy, just give me a little, you know, I'm going to say a short intro version on who you are, but I know Puggy does nothing short. So, Puggy, give me a little insight on who you are, and so for people that don't know who you are.
Well, you know, I'm just a normal person, that's for sure. Just retired from collegiate coaching in 2019, finished up at South Carolina. Almost 40 years of coaching. Started basically, we reorganized the program, men's program at Georgia Tech in 1983. I had helped the American Junior get started, ran an event in Atlanta called the Junior World Cup. And that's where I met a lot of Georgia Tech people on my committee and they were ready to almost drop the golf program. It had gotten bad. So they talked me into getting into coaching for almost little or nothing, something you couldn't survive on in Atlanta. So my wife and I took over basically almost a bankrupt junior program called the Atlanta Junior Golf Association. And we built that over a period of years into a very large program of over 1,500 kids and 60 events. And Also built a golf course in the meantime called the Standard Club in Atlanta during that time. So got into coaching and just sought out people that have been incredibly close friends and very, very have played a major influence in my coaching career. One is right there in Charlottesville, a gentleman by the name of Dr. Bob Rotella. Learned about Bob in 87, had a former player, Tripp Eisenhower, who's now on the Golf Channel. Tripp had gone to see Bob, and he came back raving about this guy and said, he's really good. And Bob had just started and was just fortunate enough to get in with him and just learn an incredible amount about the mental game. He helped me a lot in kind of developing my coaching philosophy over the years and learning that, not to be make decisions too quickly. And so he helped me keep things in perspective and helped me develop. I had a gentleman, George Kellhoffer in Atlanta, who got me through the golf machine and learning a lot about the golf swing and all its variations, and just continued to grow from there. And I'm still seeking out people. We've been doing a lot of work. I have a golf lab now, Prisma Apex Athletic Performance Golf Lab. And, we've been studying foot pressure now for many years and body movements. And we've been able to, we've got some incredible results going on there, getting people to simply move the body properly, use the ground properly. And what we're doing is we're seeing a tremendous improvement in speed, balance, and shot dispersions are a lot tighter. So that's a good thing. So
that is a good thing.
That and some, private coaching, working with some really neat, talented young players that are making a lot of improvements. So, it's like I tell people, when I retired, I didn't die, and I'm going to keep this train going as long as it'll stay on the track. So
I was about to say, for retirement, that's not a very light retirement schedule.
Yeah. Well, I there's no such thing as, I just love it too. I have a hard time really realizing most days that I'm approaching 73. But every once in a while now, my body does remind me that I'm not 40 or 45 anymore. And I was talking with David Duvall not long ago, and he's like, I told him what I was doing, he goes, "What are you doing, man? You're supposed to be retired." And I'm like, I can't do it.
The day I truly retire, I hang my shoes up and I travel to a different plane.
Yeah.
I plan on working until I can't work anymore.
I just love to learn. I mean, it's a fast game, and dealing with people and just realizing early on that when you're dealing with players and people that, I love the statement, working with thoroughbreds. Remember, a good friend of mine, our former Georgia Tech basketball coach, Bobby Crimmins, was a very close friend. And I remember him telling me, when I was bringing in the Bill McDonalds and the David Duvalls and the Stuart Sinks and the Georgia Tech, that these guys are thoroughbreds. And when you're dealing with a thoroughbred athlete, that they're like a thoroughbred, in that if you're the jockey, you've got to realize that if you hit them too hard, they won't run. If you don't hit them hard enough, they don't run. So you have to learn. You have to learn a lot about an individual to be effective, moving them along and helping them develop.
No, I think that's a great place to start. I think where most coaches and younger coaches go wrong is they think golf is a technical game completely. And it is. You do have to have certain skills and certain technical pieces that you have to be able to play the game. But to be a good coach, it's much more, and especially collegiately when you're working with a team, is being able to manage the player and understand what each player needs and what those trigger points are, that if they're a little down, you can bring them up. And if they're too high, a trigger point that might bring them down a little bit to put them in the optimal space to perform. So kind of working with some of the better players that you've worked with over time, how do you see – how did you learn that management of players was really important?
How did I learn it? I mean, I learned it very quickly that, to get them to play their very best and for me to continue being paid as a coach, that a lot depended on that. And so, again, we always treated, when I first got into coaching, we always treated our student athletes as a part of our family. They literally, my wife, I got in this at 33 years old, and It made a few moves. I was in the resort development business for a number of years, and got into this because I really, really love that. I wanted to be in that environment. So my wife and I got involved, and my daughter, she always, when she was younger, would say, you know, hey, I'm going to always have 12 older brothers. And so we treated them like our family, and I treated them like, I felt like the parents that entrusted me with their kids, that I was basically had the same interest in them that the parent had, and that is their well-being and moving them forward in every facet of life, not just the golf. But golf's important, but it's, you know, the problem with golf is that it's a crazy game, and if you make it too big, it can make your life pretty miserable. And I think you see that with some of these tour players that make it out there and then say, hey, I don't like this. I don't want to be a part of this. And I think now you're seeing with this, that the tour, it doesn't stop anymore. And I heard Rom talking about, you know, we want time to spend with our families and whatever. And then people talk about Rory. Well, you know, he's not winning every time. Well, you know what? He's got a family now. I mean, yeah. At what point, money and fame doesn't mean everything. It, you know, and you realize that, you know, when you get older, start approaching my age, I mean, you realize that, hey, you know, there's only one thing that's going to be there at the end, and that's going to be your family. So you better take care of that. So,
yeah. And I think that's really important too, as a good coach, is you've got to understand, again, they are human beings, they are players, and you have to help manage a lot of things outside of the golf course. You know, professionally, it could be, let me take worrying about tickets off your hands, and I will deal with your family members and your friends and make sure that they're taken care of. You don't need to worry about that going into Augusta like that. You know, so I think where a lot of people, again, they think to be a really good coach is, yes, I can get them to perform a movement really spectacularly on a range, when that's really not golf and really not managing the athletes. So for those that want to be high-end coaches, we've got, again, you've got to learn that they are human beings and they do have lives, and a lot of times their play will be affected by the relationships of their wife, their parents, their roommates in college, their girlfriend or boyfriend. Like, these components can really affect the way they play, because again, they are still human beings trying to manage. And I think the Rory example and the Rom example are really great, because again, the tour has started to make so much money. And again, it runs from October to October. And it's, to me, it's just the insanity of what we force these guys and ladies to do now. You know, well, they're going to pay me a lot of money to play in it. Doesn't matter.
Yeah. Well, you know what? The key thing I would tell you is that, you know, what I'm loving right now is I love working with highly motivated players. I don't care whether they're 10 years old or 90 years old. And that's what I'm doing now. And the key thing with the younger kids coming along, you know, identifying their support group, because I think there's, you know, I watched, to be honest with you, I was telling the story not long ago. In fact, I was watching a young lady that I'm working with, a 15-year-old, Caroline Hawkins, win her first AJGA a couple weeks ago here in Columbia, and spoke to some of the these young AJGA employees and talking to them about how that deal, whole deal got started, and how I think it was pretty much that era with Duvall, Justin Leonard, Phil, that whole group. I mean, literally, when we did an AJGA event, which wasn't, there weren't many of them, there were maybe two or three or four, it went to maybe 10 or 12, but the parents did not travel with the kids. You were considered a geek if your parents showed up at the tournament. And then all of a sudden, when the AJGA got bigger and the point system, the All-American, then all of a sudden there's mom and dad, there's brother, sister, there's grandmama, granddaddy, everybody's following, and everybody's keeping stats. So what I'm doing now with the young people I work with is I'm one of the very few. I basically insist that whoever the lead parent is, as far as the support group that's having the most influence over the player that they attend every session we have. I want the dad there and the player there. I want to be together. I want to talk about how hard this game is, because what is so important as kids move forward, that support, that primary support parent, be on board with, you know, how do I best, my child is becoming a thoroughbred, and what have I got to do to help the coach? And, yeah. And you know, so that's been a huge, and I'm enjoying it, but you know, I don't really, to be honest with you, I didn't do it in college, and I don't do it now. I don't tolerate overbearing parents. I mean, yeah, you know, hard enough. And I've threatened, there are a few of them that over time I threatened to put a bag on their back and, you know, we're going to take you out, let you play. And then we're going to critique every little thing you do.
So, that's right.
I mean, just parents are, they mean well, they want to help. But the biggest thing is that you got it. And I'm going to use the term that, that Steve Elkington, I think, made pretty famous years ago, digging it out of the dirt. I think kids have got to learn how to play the game on their own. I mean, it's a trial and error, especially short game. I mean, you that is totally repetition, the touch and feel, imagination. I'm big in developing mental pictures, that like driving a car. I mean, you gotta learn this stuff. You can't, every time something goes wrong technically, you can't have somebody in the loop that kid has immediate contact with, that so they're trying to always look for the quick fix, and there is no quick fix out there. So, you know, you got to let these kids, they're all on a different learning curve, so in different timetables, so we got to let them develop and be the best they can. So
yeah, we used to call those parents that were very hard on their kids, at least the group I ran around coaching wise, we call them carnivorous parents. They would eat their kids, like just literally eat them after a round, and you're just like, what are you doing? Like, do you think they really?
I don't tolerate it. I really.
I love it.
If the kid's working with me, the parent, I mean, they learn, and then the parent and the kids learn to communicate, and the parent has an opportunity to critique the parents after tournaments, and the parents can then talk about the kid, and the tournament experience, so that we leave there, we understand that you know what the parents learn is that this kid really knows a lot more than I think they do.
Yeah,
and they get it. It's just that I don't get it yet. So anyway,
that's right.
It's fun. It's a good time.
Especially the parents that can't break 100, and they're trying to tell their kid that shoots 70 what they did well and what they need to work on.
Well, the key thing is, I'm going to tell you one Rotella story that I use all the time, and I use a lot of Bob's stories because he had so many good ones, but. He Bob apparently worked in a school or a camp or something for special needs kids in like Vermont, and he taught swimming, and it was during the winter time, it's freezing cold, and he said he gets there, and the here are all these kids lined up out in front of this place, they're freezing cold. They can't wait to get in. They're so juiced about going swimming. And they get in, and he started thinking about it. He goes, okay, here are kids that if you look at them from the outside person looks in and says, boy, these kids, if maybe they've got one or two good things going on in their life, and 98% of what's going on in their life is not good.
Yeah.
But they're focusing on the 2% of what's going on in their life to get excited about. Whereas the average person looks at that they've got 98% of the things going on great in their life. They're not starving. They've got their health and everything else, but they focus on the 2% of the bad stuff going on. And I always love that story. And I use that often with parents, getting them to understand, don't look at, if you're going to sit there and critique and look and analyze every little thing they do wrong, don't follow them. I didn't follow a player step for step because I did not want to pick
out. Miserable.
I wanted to hear, let them talk about the bad stuff. And I was just going to talk about the good stuff I saw. Yeah. So that worked out pretty good for 40 years. So, you know, anyway.
Now I like with a lot of my players, we do a lot of journaling work, and I always ask them three simple questions, and I get parents to do it too. What went well? Because every round, something went well. Even if you shoot 100, something went well today. What areas do we need to work on? There's all. I don't care if you shoot 59. Look at every tour player that's ever broke 60, and they all go, man, I let one get away on six, or, you know. So there's always something to work on. And then the key question, I think, where most people go wrong is they never close the circle. For the areas, like, what do I need to work on? What am I going to do tomorrow in the next few days to close that circle? And if you kind of take that mindset of good, bad, and what I'm going to do to close the circle, then all these conversations are good, because it's just understanding strengths and weaknesses, and I'm going to create a plan, and then I can put today away. I've already created a plan. I know how to get better. Where I see most parents go wrong with a junior is they focus in, they might talk about good, but they really focus in on bad, but they just leave it there. And now there's anxiety and issues of me going, oh my God, I suck at this. My mom and dad think I can't putt or chip, or, you know, and then there's this mentality of, but you always have to close that circle. So again, I would say for the carnivorous parent out there that might have stumbled on this video, ask these, take those three questions and just say, again, how can we close the circle? You know, maybe it's a simple putting game or solution or a technique piece that we always go back to where I falter, this is what I need to fix. But again, once you create that closure, life as an athlete and a parent becomes dramatically better.
Well, and you know, what I'm doing now is that I started out doing some group stuff, and it was effective to a certain point, but, you know, the kids got better, but it got to a point in time where you can't, you know, improve a group. It's hard to improve a group without working with the individual. So that's why we started breaking it down. So I do my deal is a coaching deal where we go, we have so many hours a month, one-on-one. Then we have, you know, access. I put them on my GameForge, which I've been using since you guys started. It's extremely helpful in me not only learning, you know, after each event, after each round, you know, where are they? Where are they losing shots? You know, where you've got the ability of trending and all that stuff. Like, you know, one player we had, you know, once we started really digging into it, I think you remember this player, she's had success, that we found out that really her strategy was she was hitting the ball really well, but she wasn't being aggressive enough on scoring clubs. So she was playing wide side. She was too careful. We also found that she was leaving 90% of her putts short. And now I see a habit with a lot of good junior players that they roll the ball to the hole. They don't get it through the hole. And so the my GameForge has been incredible. And for me to be able to identify what is it that we need to look at moving forward. And then I use a video program on form, which is phenomenal, where we can exchange video. I can do voiceovers and so I'm constantly available to the player. But the one thing that I want is I want the player, even when we get into the mechanical or technical side, is that everything we do, first of all, I think as a teacher, that if you do not understand that 95% of this game for players, once they play at a certain level, is touch and feel. And the problem is that I see with teachers is they think that they can convey what they feel like they do in their golf swing, and it's going to make sense to the other player, the student. Well, it doesn't work that way. My feel is different than your feel. So I can't just do what you tell me to do and I'm going to feel the same thing. So that's why we use high-speed cameras. We use the launch monitor. The game changer, I think for me in the last 10 years has been body track and looking at foot pressure, because, you know, I love it. I'm working with Terry Hashimoto out of Canada, Jake Thurm. Jake's a young professional, is doing a great job with foot pressure. I don't think many people, even the teachers that think they know something, you know, I've been studying it for 3.5 years in a laboratory with hundreds of people coming through. And I see a common tendency where most of our people are playing on the wrong foot. It creates injuries. So we've created a program, a return to golf program, that now we can help people coming back from injuries and surgery. In a lot of cases, it's resulted from poor technique in their golf swing. So what we've got to do is when I bring a player in, and put them in front of, in my lab especially, they leave there. They understand totally what it looks like, what it feels like, what it's supposed to be like to be their optimal move. And then we give them a way to train it away from the golf ball, because what we're seeing is that you can't train a new habit with a golf ball. I mean, your brain wants to go to a trusting or performance mindset. And the problem is that a lot of these teachers have kids and players continually in a training mindset. And that is a geek mindset. It's a single tasking mindset. And then they wonder why these guys can't enjoy the game of golf and they quit. So the key thing is, from the coaching standpoint, is it's a holistic thing. It's not how you swing the golf club. It's how, you know, it's again, you've got to be the world's greatest problem solver in this game, because every shot's going to give you a new problem. Yeah. You need to know how to react to it. You know, there are only two things in this game you can control, in my opinion. One is your mind and the way you think. You can train that. You can condition it and work on it. And the other thing is the next shot. So we have to train people to trust what they're doing in 50 to 60 second increments and then move on. And so, you know, that's what I've seen. The thing that I think in coaching that makes it different from teaching, and I've just watched it for 40 years. You talk about ledgering. Every one of our kids and players I work with have a ledger. And the first thing in their ledger is a little bit about their bio, where they came from, parents, how they got started, you know, some great stories along the way. But then the next one, you know, as we go, I want them to go about 90% into the back of that ledger. And I want to know, what is your dream? I want them to have a dream, because I think if you can dream it, you can accomplish it. And for these kids, to get them to start out at, I mean, I can tell you that my kids are anywhere from 10, 11 to 15. And you ask any one of them, what's the dream? You're going to hear Masters. If it's a guy, you're going to hear U.S. Women's Open. If it's a girl, and that's their dream. And what we're doing is we're going to keep everything in perspective, because everything we're going to do along the way is to get us to that point. And, you know, the fun thing is, having worked with David Duvall for so many years, and David was number one in the world. And the times that, you know, I was with him at the Masters, the U.S. Open, where he was in the hunt to win. And it's like, I tell the kids, how do you feel what do you think you're going to feel like on Sunday morning, driving down Magnolia Lane? We used to drive down Magnolia Lane. Now you kind of cut over to the Players parking lot, but driving down Magnolia Lane on Sunday and you're in the final pairing, how do you think that's going to feel? Yeah. And they say, well, you know, it's going to be really unbelievable. Like, do you think you're going to sleep a lot, whatever? So getting them to understand that, you know what, we're going to prepare you for that, so that when you get to that point in time, and, you know, again, working with Bob Rotella, and then, you know, I always love bringing in really good players like Tom Kite. Son David played here for me for a couple of years, and to have Tom Kite and Bob Rotella in together, and to have, you know, Tom Kite, to have Tom, okay, Tom, your dream in life is what? To win the U.S. Open. And you did that, right? In Pebble Beach. Well, what were you thinking on number 18 or 72nd tee at Pebble? And you got a chance to achieve your dream. And he went into great detail about, you know, I remember specifically how he talked about his target, how it was early in the week. He had picked out on 18, the tree to the right. They cut a limb off. And he's like, you know, I got up and he goes, if I tell you that I didn't think about water to my left, I would be lying. In fact, I even thought the fact I had the entire Pacific Ocean to my left, you know, and I had to hit one more great golf shot. And he said, I'm pulling out driver. It's Mike Carrick. My caddy's pulling out 3-wood. And he said, I got into that little knot hole in that tree. And he looked at one of my players across the room and he said, it's like me getting into the pupil of your right eye. And he said, I hit the golf shot, the tournament's over. And then to have, you know, I had Michael Nicklaus for a couple of years at Georgia Tech, and have Jack come in, and had Jack and Bob come in at the same time. We did a big deal with my booster club, and to have Jack talk about the fact that he never missed a putt. like inside of 6 feet to win a tournament. And, you know, a guy raised his hand in front, who, an older guy, said, "Oh, Mr. Nicholson, I think it was like Cleveland, you missed a 6-footer." He goes, "Nope, you got the wrong guy. I never missed that." And so, I mean, to have Rotella come back and go, "Wow, is that a strong mind?" I mean, he totally, he had a, you know, his memory, he had a way to control his, what went into that memory bank. So
yeah,
it's been a real fun ride. And what I'm enjoying now is taking, you know, all those experience of, you know, being around great players and learning from them continually and learning, you know, not so much, you know, how did you handle adversity? I mean, what made you so great? Well, I mean, they were able, two things, in my opinion, they were able to stay in the moment, not get ahead of themselves. And, you know, they had short memories. I mean, they just moved on. So, you know, that's a good thing.
That is on the golf course. That is a great thing. it's such a game that will shred you apart if your memory's too long. I think kind of like Jack, you got to be, I don't know if delusional is the right word, but you've got to have that mindset that, you know, even when bad things happen, they don't really happen to me. That was a fluke. Like, yeah, no, I've never, you know, I've had players that stare at me and like, I'm about, you know, it's about to happen. And you're like, statistically, no. But I love the fact that you believe it's about to happen. It's much better than a player that has statistics to make it happen and look at you and go, yeah, I don't think I'm there. You're like, uh-oh.
Well, and the one thing too that I would say, I remember years ago, back when Jay Haas, I was spending time, Jay was coming to tournaments when Bill was playing at Wake. And I remember getting to know Jay really well and how strong his mind was. And, you know, and I remember him just looking at me and he goes, you know, you work really hard at this. And, you know, but he said, there's just one thing that you can coach as much as you want to coach, but there's one thing that you can't control and you cannot teach, and that's experience. And I think that's the key thing is, you know, you gotta let them go. You gotta let these kids go, like riding a bike, man. They got to fall over a few times in order to learn how to ride the bike and quit. You know, we went from what we used to call helicopter parents that kind of hovered. And then we went to the hedgehog parents that are the bush hog parents that just, they tried to clear the way so that their kids never had a challenge or deal with adversity. And man, oh man, I mean, we need to, you know, people ask me about their kids' conditioning program. I said, you know, put their hands on a push mower, you know, not self-propelled, push mower, let them do yard work, you know, do the stuff that we had to do as kids. I mean, you know, we can't do it for them. So it's
well, Puggy, we do have electricity now. So, you know, we can't do it exactly like when you were a kid.
Well, yeah. we have indoor plumbing now and all that stuff. Kind of nice. You know, you just have to walk, you know, a long way to get to the toilet, whatever.
No, I agree. I think, you know, it's almost, what was that, Rocky IV, where he's like fighting Drago and Drago's got all the technology and all this stuff. And Rocky's like in a barn in Siberia, like just doing insanely stuff. But then they mirrored how the old school is doing this new school stuff. It just does it different. I agree. I think, you know, and my son started playing a little over 2 years ago. Now he's starting to post a lot of rounds in the upper 70s, went from 100 to breaking 80. In a little over 2 years, and people go, well, you're a putting coach and a short game coach. I bet his putting and short game are spectacular. And I go, actually, kind of not great, because that wasn't our focus, because that's not what he needed to do to become better and golf faster. We had to get him from the tee ground onto the green really fast, because I can make you better on the putting green. Let's say you're averaging 36 putts. I can get you to 33. So I take you from 100 to 97. Well, if I can take you from tee to green and it takes you 60 shots and I can get that to 50 shots, well, now we just shot 90. Like, so the concept of kind of what you're saying is you've got to understand each individual player and their needs and where they're trying to accomplish and how to move them. And if you can take it down to that single player and move them what they need to move to get to their next level or their goal, you can be very successful as a coach. Where I see a lot of coaches going wrong is they buy into these big models and these big systems. Kind of, we talked about the player that was, hitting too far away from targets. She was risk averse, thinking, if I can prevent bogey, life is good, but you got to make birdie. If you want to compete at the highest level, you got to make birdie. So there's always a understanding there's time to hit away and there's time to be a little more aggressive. So again, I think what everything in this game is the individual game. And for you to be able to look at each individual player, know strengths and weaknesses of their game, what we're working on, what's their family life like, what equipment do they have, do we need to make changes there? Like all these components, you know, you take about 6 to 8 main components. And as a good coach, you're juggling those to put your player in a position to perform. And that to me is the heart of coaching. So, you know, and I don't think there's a better coach that I, like I said, when I was coaching, there weren't too many that I would flag down, and Puggy was one. And I always picked his brain. I don't know if he knew I was picking his brain, but I was always picking his brain, trying to get information on how to be a better coach. And those were a lot of the things that I pulled away from countless conversations with Puggy on the golf course, off the golf course, anytime we were at the same venue. So I thank you for that, Puggy. You're a big influence on what I do.
And I'll tell you this, Brian, that, and I'm not blowing smoke here. I mean, I picked your brain a lot.
Well, that only took about 8 seconds.
You probably had a lot more brain matter than I did at that point in time. But the one thing I could always tell you is that the thing that always impressed me was that I can remember we'd be paired with Virginia, and we would have, I think, in my opinion, we were from a mechanical ball striking standpoint, far better team. I mean, I could look at it and say, wow, but your kids, I mean, I've never seen a team that could putt and chip, especially putt the way. And that was back in the old days when the aim point had the book, and yeah. I'm like, you know, you, for God's sakes, please don't pair us with Virginia with these books, because they're totally oblivious to the rest of the world. So thank you. I went to the new aim point, but all I can tell you, the teams that you were part of, they always performed on the greens. And that was the great equalizer. And in most cases, put you guys ahead of the game. So that's been fun. I've learned a lot. And, you know, it's been fun over the years developing since 1983, the drills that, you know, we've incorporated a lot of them into my game forge with that I know work. I mean, I know that using these back when David and Stuart and all those guys were coming through Tech, from then on, stuff that worked. And what I can tell you is that the more you can get your practice, short game practice, to resemble the competition and be result oriented. All of the stuff that we do for the most part is result oriented. They have to achieve certain things before they can move on to the next shot. And then if we identify one that's not very good, then we go to the repetition and get that better. But you know, it's a great game. It's just, again, no matter how old you are or young you are,
always learning.
I mean, I just love it. I love the fact that these kids now are committing, and my God, the players that we have coming on now, I think it's been wonderful to see these younger players. I mean, most of these guys, I look on the Korn Ferry Tour, I don't know anybody out there, you know.
And, they're wow. shooting nothing. And they're shooting nothing.
So, and it's just, it's fun to watch. And
I agree. I think, I think the whole learning part is kind of fun. I've been traveling a bunch lately, and we were doing a clinic the other day, and the night before I did the clinic, I was hanging out with a good friend of mine. We were actually in Ireland, Gareth, and we were having a couple pints, and we're talking grip pressures or whatever. And he goes, make a fist. So I made a fist. He goes, all right, now put your pinky out. He goes, can you make a fist anymore? No, you can't. So then literally the next morning, I'm working with a player, and they have like a death grip on the putting grip. And I just go, release your pinkies. And he went from this to this, and he started making putts, and he goes, oh, that feels so much better. You know, and I'm just like, just a random conversation about something, the next immediate day I was able to apply and help a player. And I think to me as a coach, there's the holy grail is we don't know. Like, we know stuff, but we don't know all the stuff. So we're, as a player, is always on a quest to look for stuff. You as a coach better be on that same quest, because again, that's how you're going to, you know, elevate your game as a coach. And for Puggy to be 45 and continuing that quest every weekend, week out, is actually spectacular.
Yeah. Well, you can't. I tell you what. You know, this game is a game of adversity, mistakes, and you know, you better learn how to handle it. And I think for kids, I mean, it's I've just never had a young person commit to this game that didn't turn out absolutely incredibly good, because
I agree.
It's like life. I mean, you just get your butt handed to you a lot, and you got to come back, you know, yep. No matter how bad it is. So, you know, wish them all the best.
All right. Well, what we'll do is we're going to go ahead and close this one down. I appreciate Puggy taking time. We'll bring Puggy back. I love talking with Puggy. But I do want to ask the fans, you did make a reference earlier, and I want to know, you talked about Trip Eisenhower. I want to know, do the fans listening to this podcast know where Trip is the most famous? Yes, he was a spectacular collegian. Yes, he was a great professional. Yes, he works as a great broadcaster. But how do most people know Trip? Because right when you said Tripp's name, I mentally thought of
the Hawk. That was, you know what, that was really unfortunate. You know, the way that all went down. I mean, you know, when I was, he was telling me about it, and I was learning more about it. I mean, he was at the end of a video shoot. I think he's worked with Rotel a long time. I think they were doing a series together, and he was doing a video shoot. He's right at the tail end, and this bird's just squawking and carrying on in the background, and they can't film. And I think he just, you know, turned around and he just kind of hit a ball at the tree to get the hawk to fly off. Well, I mean, he hit the hawk and killed it, you know, and he just happened to have, you know, several PETA people on there. But I thought about, you know, what a great, I immediately started thinking, what a great and credible video to do. It's like, I mean, here I mean, I've got a former player that can hit a hawk from 150 yards. Kill it.
That's what it is.
It was absolutely totally unfair what he went through with that.
No, I agree.
I mean, they just, I mean, even the PGA Tour, everybody got involved.
I agree.
I know it was very hard on he and his family, but thank God he survived it and moved on.
Yeah, now his PR firm had to be better than the other PR firm. But it's hard to outdo PETA. But well, thank you, Puggy, for joining us, and we look forward to bringing you more videos like this in the weeks to come. Thank you so much.
Well, let's do it. Let's do the next one from Ireland.
We can do that. Worst case, South Carolina. I'll come visit you, but we're definitely going to be heading to Ireland soon.
Okay. Let me know when.
All right.
This has been a Fuel production.